is Lenora Bluen, and I'm happy to be here this morning to share with you a reading from the scriptures. And this is from the second chapter of Genesis, verses 18 to 25. And it is a translation by Stephen Mitchell. And the Lord said, "It is not good for the man to be alone. I will make for him a partner to help him." So from the ground, the Lord formed all the animals and all the birds and brought each one to the man to see what he would call it. And whatever the man called it, that was its name. And the man gave names to all the birds and to all the animals. But for the man, no partner was found. So the Lord caused a deep trance to fall upon the man. And as the man slept, the Lord took one of his ribs and closed up his side with flesh. And he built the rib into a woman, and he brought her to the man. And the man said, "This one at last is bone from my bone and flesh from my flesh. She shall be called woman, because from man she was taken. That is why a man leaves his father and mother and joins with his wife, and they become one flesh. And both of them were naked, the man and his wife, and they felt no shame." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
Will you pray with me? May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts hold your word, something of that one hand that belongs in ours, dear God, for you are our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. An anthropologist who was studying a Hopi tribe of Native Americans noticed how often the word rain, the idea of rain, appeared in the art and the music of the Hopi people. And so he asked the leader of the tribe why so many of the people's songs dealt with rain. "It's because water is so scarce in the land where we live," the Hopi leader replied. And then after a minute, that Native American turned and asked the anthropologist, "Is that why so many of your songs are about love?" This is the second in a series of sermons on the power of authentic relationships. I want you to hear something intentional in my decision to put this series first in the long course of Sunday morning conversations that we are just beginning. Authentic, honest, loving relationships are the foundation for everything else we do with our lives. They are what we rely on for stability. They are also what lead us to change, to our own transformation. The central relationships in our lives, relationships with our spouses or partners, our parents and children, our friends, are not only fixed pieces in our daily routines, they are also the backpack that we carry around with us all the time, whether we want to or not. Wherever we go and whatever else we are doing, the temperature of those primary relationships, worry or fear or conflict or the sense of well-being that they bring us, those influence our reactions to everything else. They have the power to weigh us down and sink our spirits or to raise us up so that we can embrace life. The ways we love the most important people in our lives are an important thing to talk about in church, I think, because those relationships are the laboratory where we experiment and practice with what it means to be loved by God and to love God back. What it looks like in our day-to-day real lives to put love at the center of our intentions and our actions. More and more, as I pay attention to the words and to the life of Jesus, I am convinced that loving God and loving others are not just the two most important commandments. In some essential way, they're the same commandment. When Jesus said, love one another, I think he meant real people. He was talking about loving people who have actual faces and bad habits. He knew, I think, how easy it is to declare that we love humanity and how hard it is to forgive the person who kept us awake all night with their snoring. Over and over again in the Bible, the relationship between God and God's people is spoken of in the image of a bride and bridegroom, or a husband and wife. Our own relationships of covenant and promise help us to understand and to reflect on the kind of faithful love that God has for us and what covenant with God means. Making and keeping vows means loving people we sometimes feel stuck with. Caring for people to whom we are bound by a promise that lasts much longer than the feeling that led us to that promise. And the challenges of those relationships remind us of the love of God, who, quite frankly, is stuck with us. So today I want to talk particularly about lifelong relationships. The kind of relationships that are embodied in marriage and lifetime commitments, regardless of the partner's gender. The story from Genesis that Lenora read a few moments ago is part of the biblical story of the creation of the earth. I can imagine ancient people sitting around a fire late at night and a child asking, "Why do the adults always seem to pair up? Why do they always look for one person to go home with?" And so this story of Adam and Eve was told in response. It is the story of two people who are closely and invisibly connected with one another. So much in need of each other's partnership that it is as if they shared a rib or some other part of their bodies. I notice that the story says nothing about sexuality. Their relationship and the point of this story is not about sex. I hear in this story that what is meaningful, what God honors and encourages, is a connectedness of whole persons, a commitment that can happen regardless of the sexual identity or gender of the people who make that commitment. Often, the feeling that leads us toward making that kind of lifelong commitment is a sort of romantic exhilaration that comes from feeling that we are fully seen by someone else. When we fall in love, we reveal ourselves. We let someone else see the parts of ourselves that are hidden from most of the world. Being known in this way is what we call intimacy, a word that I understand best by breaking apart its syllables. Intimacy, into me see. Intimacy is what gives marriage and life partner relationships an immense power in our lives. There is someone right next to us who can see in us something different than the well-crafted image that we present to the world. Sometimes this is the only person who sees us without makeup, both literally and figuratively. Each partner becomes the mirror through which the other sees himself, Each one holds in her hands the other's self-image and need for approval. That makes this relationship the tool that can transform us. But it also makes this kind of relationship perilous, because each partner has great power to heal or to deeply wound the other. Often when I perform weddings, I say something like this to the couple getting married. I say, for each of you, the calling you must listen to and follow is not only to reach your own destiny, but to help your loved one find hers or his. The calling of marriage is to tend your partner's spirit, to stand by the other as a tangible reminder of the presence of love and constancy in life. And the reward of marriage is that you too will have the companionship of the one whom you most love and respect, and whose love and respect you need to make you whole. And as I say that to freshly in love and romance-filled young couples, it seems like an obvious thing to promise. But that obligation to tend someone else's need for affirmation and unconditional acceptance is what we are most likely to misplace along the long road of a lifetime relationship. The truth is that of all the places we go and the people we encounter every day, for many people, home feels like the place where they are most criticized instead of most treasured. John Wellwood, who is one of my favorite writers on marriage, says, "This is one of the most striking phenomena I observe in working with couples. How often they have much more energy for making each other wrong than for setting things right between them. Almost all of any couple's grievances against one another," he says, "are different forms of the same complaint, which is, you don't love me as I am." Wellwood calls this the most fundamental sorrow that there is. Sometimes I think this is the one thing that could most completely change the quality of our marriages. For each of us to remind ourselves over and over again, until our behavior changes, that you are the one whose understanding and support and love your partner needs more than anyone else's in the whole world. That home is where we come to find the unconditional acceptance that is in short supply almost everywhere else we go. At some level, we know this already. That's what makes us stress compatibility so heavily when we're looking for the right person to marry. But the truth is that none of us stays the same person we were on our wedding day. Every marriage is about two flawed people who don't have a clue about what lies ahead or who they will become. Stanley Hauerwas, who's a United Methodist clergy person who taught ethics at Duke University, says that when he marries couples, he gives them a sealed envelope and tells them not to open it until things get really difficult in their marriage. And when they do finally open the envelope, usually years later, every couple reads the same message. It says, "Everyone marries the wrong person." Now, when I first heard that story, I thought it seemed hopelessly cynical. But actually, I think it's a pretty good message for couples who feel their marriage is in trouble. It reminds them that most of the time, the issue is not about who you married. The solution is not to go out searching again for the right person. It's about remembering that no matter what your reasons were for getting married, the reasons for staying married or something else. The author Mary Pfeiffer tells a story about visiting an older couple in the Midwest, and she interviewed them about the key to their 60-year marriage. "How have you done it?" Mary asked them. And the husband responded first. He said, "Mary, I have one thing I do. I get up every morning, and I go to the mirror, and I look at it, and I look at myself, and I say to myself, 'You're no prize either.'" Marriage calls us to abandon our longing for the perfect, both in our partner and in ourselves. No one remains as sublimely lovable as he was on the day you fell in love with him, or as beautiful as she was on your wedding day. The passions and illusions of love ebb, and if we are lucky, they flow again. And every day in between, we are required to remember that we are married. Married while we love imperfectly and are imperfectly lovable. John Gottman, another psychologist whose work on marriage I admire, found in decades of working with married couples that 69% of the conflicts that they argue about never go away. 69%. That means if you're inclined as a couple to argue about a particular issue or a difference between you, you're likely to deal with that same conflict forever. One of you will always avoid emptying the dishwasher, and the other will never learn to use their car's turn indicator correctly. That doesn't mean that things are hopeless. It just means that solving things by eliminating the differences between you is not the answer. What makes a marriage work, Gottman says, is to find a way to come back together every time you notice and are irritated by those persistent differences. To forgive each other for not being someone else, and to have a path that leads back to connection after every one of those predictable arguments. Even a relationship made of sterling can get tarnished. Over time, a lot of things happen that damage us, wound us, and wear us down. And all of those things can dampen even the most bright, hot love. After that, staying together is, in some ways, in spite of it all. I heard someone say once, "Love at first sight is easy to understand. It's when two people have been looking at each other for 40 years that it becomes a miracle." And that seems to me very much like faith. The writer of Hebrews says that faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. In other words, faithfulness is holding on to God even when our prayers go unanswered and we cannot feel that warm and inspiring presence. Faithfulness to our partners means loving them even when we have lost sight of why it is we loved them in the first place. Sometimes, what makes a relationship endure is simply remembering that something precious and fragile has been put in our hands. You have been given another life to hold as dearly and carefully and lovingly as you hold your own. Hold it with care. Amen.